Okay, let's pray real quick and then we'll get going. Thank you, God, for this time, for everyone here, for your redemption and your preservation of your people. You've always been faithful to us, no matter our faithfulness or faithlessness. Thank you, God, for your goodness. In the name of Yeshua, amen. I just want to touch on a few brief points because Ricky and Cheryl have something to share. So some add-ons to what Rabbi Michael shared. I'm gonna ground this in the Bible and from 1 Corinthians 7. You'll notice I don't have a PowerPoint. Just be grateful I found my clothes. So it was boxes still around the house. Still haven't found my tikkun to help me read the Torah, but we're here. We're okay. I did shower, so everything's fine. Hot water. So 1 Corinthians 7, starting at verse 17. I'm going to read it, and then I'm going to explain it. Only as the Lord has assigned to each one, as God has called each, let him walk in this way. I gave this rule in all of Messiah's communities. Was anyone called when he was already had been circumcised? Let him not make himself uncircumcised. Has anyone been called while uncircumcised? Let him not allow himself to be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing and uncircumcision is nothing, but keeping God's commandments matters. Let each one remain in the calling in which he was called. The point I'm going to draw from this is that Jewish culture is the culture of the Jews. And we shouldn't forsake it because necessarily it was a culture that also, as a whole, rejected Jesus, Yeshua. They saw him as the other, the persecutor. And I get it. My grandmother was chased down the streets when she was growing up in Newport, Rhode Island, by Catholics who said, "You killed Christ." So how do you reconcile Jewish culture with that? So she goes back to her mom, who also experienced persecution in Russia, and she said, "Well, did we kill Jesus?" And she said, "No, the Romans did." So then she went back to the Catholic kids and said, "My mom said the Romans killed killed Jesus." And they said, "Well, the nun told us the Jews did." You're at a complete impasse. How do you reconcile these things? But the fact is that God has redeemed our culture and continues to do so. And like Rabbi Michael said, we shouldn't. Yes, we do have Israel, and Israel's a fulfillment of a dream that was long. It's been part of the Jewish culture for millennia. But still, there's an aspect of the Jewish culture that it shouldn't be forsaken because it's what God has called, brought us into that. And it's also something just really enjoyable if you've ever experienced it. And I also want to point out from Revelation 5, verse 9. It says, this is all this, the holy ones, the kadoshim, the living creatures, the elders, angels. They're singing a new song saying, "You are worthy," this is Yeshua, "to take the scroll and to open its seals, for you were slain. And by your blood you redeemed for God those from every tribe and tongue and people and nation." Notice the four descriptions of a specificity of the people. And I bring it out because every culture, whether it's Jewish, Hispanic, Korean, European, whatever, God has, it's not by accident. And it just because it's not something else doesn't mean it's not good. God has a reason. We're all individuals. We all have specific idiosyncrasies, propensities, pasts, talents, and they're all to be used for the glory of God. If it's Jewish culture, being Jewish, then great, be Jewish. And if it's something else, great, use it for the glory of God. But since we're focusing on Yiddishkeit, they're really fun things about us. That's why it's good to bring these things out and to revel even in just the culture that we have. But it goes for everybody. All of us have come from a specific culture, and it's all redeemed by God and to be used for God's glory. But now we're going to focus on the Jewish one. So a couple of things about, I'm just going to go through a few things about Jewish culture. And like Rabbi Michael was saying, Yiddish was the primary language. Yiddish is an old form of Old German mixed with Hebrew, Aramaic, and some other languages from Polish and some of the Slavic tongues. But if you were to hear it, if anybody's ever heard the Amish, it sounds kind of similar. It's Old German, but there are a lot of words in there that you have no idea. They're Hebrew, but then their accent's a little bit different. Hence, when I sang that song, the Hebrew sounded a lot different than what we're used to. But that's how Yiddish sounds. It's a very direct language. There's no subtlety to this language. It's raw, it's honest, and it's also inherently religious. meaning it's a religion, it's a language that is part of the religion. And I'll tell you what I mean. So for instance, when we go to the bathroom, after you use the bathroom, you take toilet paper. Well, in Yiddish, the toilet paper is called Asher Yoitzer paper. What's Asher Yoitzer? Asher Yoitzer is the blessing you say after you use the bathroom. Believe it or not, there's part of Jewish culture is after you use the bathroom, you thank God that you work. Because anybody who's not gone to the bathroom and it didn't work, you pray. So it may seem silly to us, but Jewish culture is always about blessing God for anything, including going to the bathroom. And so the paper itself is named after the blessing. Isn't that interesting? So the language is based around God and our culture and our ways. It's not separate from it. Of course, there comes with the language also produced a very wry sense of humor. Jewish humor is something that's very, again, forward. And it's often something that's very rough. And it doesn't beat around the bush. It's not so much an angry humor, but it is a very direct and can be a poignant humor. And it often is used to kind of quell the reality of suffering that was so much characterized Jewish culture in Europe. You're making light of situation because, frankly, it's just too difficult to bear. And as the words of Mel Brooks, when he would often make fun of Jewish culture and Jewish suffering, they said, "How could you do that?" He said, "Well, my choices are to laugh or to cry, and I prefer to laugh." So there's a part of it that makes light of things, and almost, you know, this is bad, and the Jewish response is, "Well, it could be worse." So that's often you'll hear. Or another response is, it sounds funny, but this is true. How was it? Eh. Right? Because you don't get very high because you're expecting something bad to happen, but you don't get low because you've already experienced worse. It's sad, but this is a culture which our people came. Hence why even when they got to Israel, in many respects, the Israeli leadership forbade Yiddish. Because it was a language of exile and of suffering. They said, we want to be now a new Jew who is going to fight for ourselves, going to make our own land. We're going to take care of ourselves, and we want to have a new identity. There's, of course, food. Right? I remember going to my grandmother's house, and we would be full by before we got to the table. She put out so much food. Before, and we always say, "Well, I want more. She'd bring it out. And I'd say, "Okay, now it's time to sit down to eat." So we'd sit. Like, okay, I don't know how we're going to do this, but we're going to do it. And I never stopped eating at her house. And she'd just smile. She'd say, "Well, you have a hollow leg. That's where you put your food." I said, but she loved to give us food. Yiddish, the Jewish culture is not a big culture of drinking. But there's a funny saying, it says, Yiddish loves a drink, but not a drinker. So you have times of l'chaim, right? Drinking maybe schnapps or scotch, or a little drink, but always keeping everything in moderation. Food is, you know, miraculously we talk about the enemies of the people of Israel. Well, if you knew what went into Jewish cooking, you'd think the food would kill us, right? If you really want to make matzah balls, you don't use oil. You use chicken fat, schmaltz, right? This also comes from a place that people didn't have a lot. So you use what you had. And if you had fat, you used it. Also, frankly, when you're cold, you know what keeps you warm? Fat. And you don't have a lot of clothes, or some families would share one pair of shoes. So how do you keep warm? You eat a lot. You never saw an anorexic polar bear. Right? They need to keep warm. So it's the same thing in Jewish life. If you ate, that means you were well fed and you could stay alive. A funny story of my mom going to my great-grandmother's house, who came from Europe. She saw my mom once. They were visiting in Florida. This is where Jews go. And she said, Naomi, she said, you've gaining a little weight. And so she's 16. She's like, oh, thanks, Grandma. So she kind of pushes the food away for her. And then my great-grandmother says, there's no dieting in my house. There's always this double-edged sword. Like I said, it's obviously an inherently religious culture. There was no division necessarily of, oh, your religious is part of our life, it's religious, this part is secular. It was all mixed together. So you'll hear even in Yiddish constantly, God willing, please God, with God's help, thank God, or as my mother-in-law likes to say, thank God a million times. Right? So God is always part of the equation. So it's a beautiful thing when you hear that, you know, no matter how religious somebody is, God's part of there, and you're always asking for God's help to do certain things. This includes even my grandfather. His father was, even though he's an atheist, when asked to make a minyan, which is a quorum of 10 men so you could pray, he would go. Why? Because that's what Jews do. Because they need a 10th man, so you go make the minyan so that they could pray. Even though God was not in his life whatsoever, you did it because that's what you do. The big focus, of course, of Jewish life is education. This, of course, is very much within religious education, studying the Torah and the Talmud for hours on end, which was the goal of every man. Remember Reb Tevye? If I could just study all day, I would be very happy. The funny story of when I was in eighth grade, I got an award for the Presidential Fitness Award. So I went up there to get it, and I got back, and my grandfather said, maybe next time you'll get an academic award. I said, oh, thanks, Grandpa. Of course, there's the provision for family. A man works hard to provide for his family, doing whatever he has to so that they can survive, and as well as for the community. There's a saying that comes from the Talmud, but it's also replete in Jewish culture, is Kol Yisrael Aravim Ze Baze. All of Israel is responsible for one another. So you hint to see that how many Jewish philanthropic organizations are there, or charities, because we would always take care of one another. And even in today in Israel, I'll never forget, I moved to this apartment in Jerusalem. I took a shower. I hear the doorbell. So I threw my towel around my waist. I went up to the door. I was like, yes, there's no shirt. There's this religious man saying, tzedakah, tzedakah, asking for charity. I'm like, I don't have a shirt. I'm sorry. I have no money to give you right now. But it's so part of Jewish life that people just will go around door to door asking for charity. And the fact is they'll get it. You know, people say no soliciting here in America. you can't fight it. People are always asking because people will give because it's part of what Jews do. So that's about all I want to share because I want to – oh, actually, no, that's not true. I have some good jokes because they're worth it, and they do tell – jokes are funny, but jokes also tell a lot about a culture. So I'm going to end on a good note, and then I'm going to hand it over to Cheryl. There's a few good jokes that just give you an idea of Jewish culture. So an elderly Jewish man faints and is rushed to the nearest hospital. A nurse tucks him into bed and says, Mr. Schwartzman, are you comfortable? Schwartzman replies, I make a living. A Jewish grandfather takes his grandchildren to the beach. They're playing in the sand when suddenly a massive wave comes and pulls the smallest grandson out into the water. Panicked, the grandfather prays to God, oh God, please bring him back. Please let him live. Suddenly, an even bigger wave bursts out of the ocean, setting the little boy down right at his grandfather's feet. He scoops him up into a hug. Then he stares up at the sky and said, he had a hat. There is this there is this audacity in Jewish culture that stems back to Yaakov, our father. You know, he wrestled with God. Jewish people don't have much issue with talking to God quite forthrightly. A group of five, this is very, I've experienced this personally in my own life. A group of five Jewish women are eating lunch in a busy cafe. Nervously, their waiter approaches the table. Ladies, he says, is anything okay? If you ever go out to eat in the five towns of New York, you'll know exactly what I mean. And I'm going to give you a personal example of this. So I used to, there used to be a couple that would come in almost weekly. Mrs. Samuels and Mr. Barron. They were living together. They weren't married. Big money came in. You knew it. And it's like, uh-oh, everyone get ready. Here they come. So they would have their drinks ready, set them on the table. And then they'd come and sit down and says, what's good tonight? I said, well, here's the menu. And I'll read off the specials. And she says, you know what? I want the scallops. Okay? Don't be surprised by that. She says, I don't want salt. I don't want butter. I don't want oil. And then Mr. Barron butts in, I don't want fish. They'll specify, if you ever worked in a restaurant and you've seen the tickets that come into the kitchen, they're this long with all the specifications and the do's and the don'ts for it. And if you get it wrong, they'll send it back no matter how busy it is. Last joke, it's Yom Kippur. They're going through the service. Everyone's going, you know, the cantor's going on and on. Everyone's staring there. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. I'm hungry. The rabbi looks around. He says, you know what? No one's looking. I'm going to sneak out the back and go to the golf course. So sure enough, the rabbi backs himself out, gets out into the side, and he gets to the golf course. He's all alone. All his congregants are in the congregation. And he starts playing, and it's the best day of his life. He can't miss. Every shot is amazing. He's not hooking. He's not slicing. He finally gets to the end. He said, oh, my gosh. I cannot believe this day I'm having. This is the best golf of my life. Up in heaven, the angels are staring down in shock and awe. And they look to God and they say, God, what are you going to do? Did you see what the rabbi's playing golf on Yom Kippur? And God looks at them and he says, who's he going to tell? On that note, I invite Cheryl, and she's going to share with us a little bit about her mother, Sandy, and about her upbringing.
So, Ricky, we're going to kind of share telling you guys about this. Well, yeah, I can see. Ricky can see. But I'm going to sit because I have not been feeling particularly well. So Mom would have gotten such a kick out of this. This would have been the best thing for her in the entire world. So, and we're hoping the technology will not bomb out on us because we managed to find a couple of clips in Yiddish. Okay, you could, next slide. So this is in honor of Mom. That was her at her bat mitzvah, which she was intensely proud of. Ricky? Yeah, that would have been her. If you look up there, it says a child honors his mother more than his father because his mother's affects him by her words. That's from the Talmud, and it goes on to say that that's why you give dad respect, because otherwise he would get nothing. sorry. At any rate, this is in honor of you, Mom. Go ahead. So as was mentioned before, we're like ice cream cones. We come in more than one flavor. Our particular ice cream cone flavor was Ashkenazic. That was our parents were from Northern Europe, from Poland, and from the Ukraine, and were native Yiddish speakers, as were our parents. Okay, next. So we're going to keep it simple. It is an immense subject. You cannot do Yiddishkeit in a day, in 2 days, in 10 days, probably in a semester course. So this is our family's experience. Next slide. Some definitions. Yiddish is the language of Northern European Jewry, also known as the Ashkenazim. Yiddishkeit is the quality of being Jewish, at least for Northern European Jews. What? Oh, do I have to sit on a chair? Oh, that's okay. I don't need to be seen. I don't mind being the voice in the hidey hole. But anyway, Yiddishkeit is quality of being Jewish, at least according to Northern European Jews, and the ways its ways of life and customs and practices, which are distinct and different from the Sephardim and any of the other Jewish groups of peoples around the world. Next. So the Yiddish language has been said 9 million times. It's a language of Northern and Eastern European Jews. It's called a fusion language. What a fusion language is a language that's born of more than one language. And so you get a combination of grammars as well. It is at least 1,000 years old. It uses Hebrew orthography. There's an example of it up there. And it looks just like Hebrew. My grandfather had all of these Yiddish papers, right? And they were all in what looked like Hebrew, but it was really Yiddish. And I think there are some extra letters in there, too. Somehow seem to remember that. It is an ironic language. It uses double entendre, uses a lot of puns. There are three dialects. The one that the rabbi was using was Polish. It was deeply, deeply, deeply influenced by Talmudic thought. It is not an exaggeration to say that it was truly a language that was rooted in the Bible and in just the way Jews thought about the world. And it's infused with superstition, so this was something I just recently learned. Did you know?
I did not.
Okay. So did you know that lots of times in Yiddish, if you want to say something positive, you say something negative, because if you said something positive, then that would be a bad thing.
And if you said it positive, you'd have to go kanahora, which means not really. And then if you really were super superstitious, and I remember my grandmother actually spitting.
Oh, yeah, there's the poo-poo.
And you have to do this. You kind of like Spock.
You know, yeah, it's like the devil's horns. It's poo-poo-poo. You know, always, right? Sometimes I think some people even threw salt. Anyway, as complex as the people were complex. Next slide. So Yiddish curses. We talked a little bit about this. There's actually more than one kind. There's some really nasty versions. But the ones most of us think about are curses like, may you grow in the ground with your feet in the air and your head in the ground like an onion. Lots of times those types of quintessential curses began with a blessing, and then the blessing was flipped on its head. And the cleverer the use of language, the better. Next. Okay, you want to do this one?
Sure, I feel like the kid in the group that didn't do the work and is still up front, so Cheryl did a beautiful job with this. Yiddish culture and Jewish culture is bound with rules, and I'm sure it can be very confusing to people who are not of the Jewish culture. There's multiple viewpoints. Like some people feel like shrimp is kosher because it has, I think, one scale somewhere on its body. And other people will say that shellfish is shellfish. So you'll have different rules. And I remember very distinctly my mother would never eat anything with meat or milk. And I remember saying to her, but chickens don't have udders. And it didn't matter to her. She physically couldn't eat it. But she would go to a restaurant and order catfish without a problem. So it was consistently inconsistent, especially in Virginia. There's a majority view there. There's very much a groupthink. And so, I think that's a safety issue.
So also amongst the rabbis, even when they were, if you were to look at the Talmud, you would see multiple opinions. It kind of went with the group opinion, but I just read this. It was really interesting, Ricky and y'all.
Ricky did all the work.
Yeah. But it was really interesting that during the, in one of the Hasidic neighborhoods, there's something called an aruv. We'll tell you about that later. But this one rabbi had deemed that it was not an aruv for a bunch of really complicated reasons that I couldn't follow. But the long and the short of it is that basically he was saying, I don't care what this other guy's opinion is. My opinion counts, and if you don't follow it, you're out of line.
And you see that in the New Testament when you see, well, you know, Rabbi Gamaliel, or you see, you know, even essences of that in Scripture where people followed this person or that person. Even in the Torah readings today where a group of people went with one person, which wasn't of God, and then there was David and Nathan and Bathsheba and Solomon. You know, so there was even that essence in the Old Testament.
We allow for disagreements of opinion. Lots of times, if you look at the history in Christianity, there was a lot of heresy stuff going on. And that doesn't mean that in the Jewish community that they didn't sometimes give what was called a harem. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it correctly, but basically you were blackballed. But we allowed for multiple views. It was kind of like I said before. We did allow for multiple views so you didn't have like blood problems where people were killing each other over a disagreement.
However, there was a certain standard, and my grandmother was a beautician, and she had a shop, and because they were very poor, and they were trying to make a living, she was serving people on Saturday, and the Hasidic community basically said, if you continue to do that, we will blackball you. So it was very powerful. You would think in New York City, there's a lot of place to go, but in the community, following the rules, you could stretch it, but so far, there was still someone who would tell you no and command the community, and that was the rabbi.
So we
can go to the next slide.
So we had legal fictions. There's a lot of them to get around the rules. The Eruv is one. So in Eruv, to jump ahead, but in an Eruv, so growing up, women would wear keys on their dresses. Why, you ask, would they wear keys on their dresses on Shabbat? They couldn't carry them. They weren't allowed to because you can't carry anything outside of your home on Shabbat. What an Eruv does, it creates a space, and within that space you can do things that you would do in your home. So people could roll their babies in a baby carriage. People could put a key in a purse instead of wearing it on their clothing. They could carry a diaper bag. I mean, there's some really good practical reasons that you would create an Eruv, but it really is a legal fiction because it's still outside.
Same with the lighting of the candles. How many of you here, when you light the candles on Friday night, you cover the eyes? Well, that was the idea, was that you really aren't supposed to light something on Shabbat. So it's a little bit of playing peekaboo with your candlesticks. So again, that's a legal fiction.
Go ahead, next slide. This one was yours, I think.
So the rabbis mentioned about education. Most speak to Jewish families. That's a huge piece of our culture. And because so many of us come from a place of poverty because we were immigrants, that the understanding that education would lead you to a higher place, whether it be Hebraic education to keep the culture alive, or the secular. That's why you see so many Jews who have higher degrees.
So our world was a world where children, boys particularly, went to school, went to heder by 3, and they frequently would get their first day of school, they'd get a little cake and it'd be covered with honey because they wanted in a very, very concrete way to let this child know that learning is sweet. Daily study, that was something every man really, really, that was like goal one. And in some families, in Europe anyway, I don't know about the United States, but in some families, an agreement would be made between the bride's father and the groom that they would live with the bride's family for a year so the husband could study.
That, I think, is why we chose the picture of mom at the Torah, because we take for granted that there's a bat mitzvah, as same as a bar mitzvah, but for her and her culture, that wasn't done. So that was a big step for her to stand before the Torah.
That happened in the 1940s. They started bat mitzvahs around the 1940s.
Next slide.
Grandma's house.
This is where she lived.
I don't know if you can really see, but we've got Grandma's beauty shop that was downstairs. So the way it worked and works in at least New York then and now, apparently, is that it's got living space above the building, but the lower part of the building is commercial. And so in that very corner, there was this grocer, and he was loud. And he'd get up every morning, and you'd hear wham, bang. And then you'd hear bop, 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 in Yiddish. And then you'd hear wham, bang. And the back of the truck would open. And then you'd hear bop, 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 bop. And then you'd hear wham, bang. And It was bad to sleep in that front room because it was really, really noisy. But where it says grandma's apartment, that corner apartment was where she lived.
Next slide. This is where she went to temple, and the famous cantor Kosovitsky, he sang there, and for the longest time, especially when we came to Ohev, she would stay home and listen to Kol Nidre there. She was very anti us coming to Ohev. There were male and female sections, and there was also a basement, because even though we struggle with length of service, their length of service was much longer than our ever length of service. So I remember being a free-ranging child and running to the basement, because in the women's section there was one man who would come by and go, shh, 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 shh. So it was a painful experience going for me, going to temple. So I really didn't learn to love liturgy until I came to faith. I was doing everything I could to escape it.
I was okay with it. But then there were these great stairs, and you'd run up and down those stairs. You remember the stairs?
No, I was trying to run out the building. So we need to go on, though, because of time. Next slide.
And so that's just the inside.
And the music was beautiful because it was all male. So it was, if you listen to all male a cappella, it is actually stunning. So that's what it looked like.
It looks different now from when it did back then. But if you look... If you look, you can see that there's this almost wall of partition there. That is probably also a woman's section. But those, the bank of seats up to the side, and there was also some going this way. That's where Grandma sat. That bank of seats also was the woman's section and probably still remains so.
Next slide, please.
That's Borough Park. Okay, so there are lots of different groups of Hasidim. They came late to Borough Park, and they are descendants, at least in philosophy, of Israel ben Eliezer, or he was also known as the Baal Shem Tov. He began the movement in the Ukraine in the 18th century. Next slide. There's that roof that I was telling you about. So that... Somebody went out and actually went around the outside of this community, and they put a wire of some sort. I saw a picture of them doing that. And that area inside is the Eruv, and that would allow you to do some things that you wouldn't normally be able to do in the public domain. And there's a sign saying, there isn't an Eruv in this community, so don't do any bad stuff. Next slide. Next slide.
They're trying.
Ah, High Holy Days. Okay, next slide. So there was a lot of dancing in the street during holidays and Shabbat. We had the opportunity, both of us, at one point or another, to actually hear the men dancing in Shabbat, singing down the street, and dancing down the middle of the street in our grandmother's neighborhood. So there's some pictures of some guys doing their dancing. Next. And there are just some pictures. Right after Yom Kippur, you would always see the sukkahs go up in the most unlikely places because there really was no place to put them except the fire escape. Next. And, of course, dancing with the Torah during Simchat Torah. Next. Quirky customs, I think.
Hey, they were originally green people. I actually brought the juice glass that we used in childhood. It's, if any of you light Yahrzeit candles... This was our juice glasses. I brought one.
They wasted nothing. We also have a sense cup, a sense pot out there. That's where our grandmother put her used tea bags, added water, made an essence of sort, and continued to use the tea essence, and she'd pour hot water in.
Until there was no tea. It was just hot water. We also have certain customs. As I listen to what Rabbi Aaron is saying, it makes me laugh because... when people come into our homes and we're serving food, at least all the women say, do we have enough? Is there enough? Are you sure there's enough? And there's always enough, apparently.
There's.
We do long green beans for a long life, round carrots or long carrots.
Or long noodles or stuffed things or sweet things.
Yeah. The idea of placing red ribbons around, again, the superstitiousness of the family. I don't know about, apparently my mother and my grandmother took shots of coffee before Yom Kippur. I did not know about
that. They counted 10 of them. I've asked everywhere. Nobody can figure out what the 10 sips of coffee meant, but that's what they did.
I think they were taking shots of caffeine before. And I kind of laugh because Neil actually remembers my, he's from my sister's, he's one of my sister's friends and a fellow there with the gray hair. And no offense, Neil, not to call you out, but he remembers some of these weird things. She had weird rules about what you could and couldn't do. And of course, that impacted us when we came to faith. She could not figure, either you believed in Jesus and you were a Catholic, or Puerto Rican.
And only a Catholic.
Or Puerto Rican, or Irish. Protestants didn't even play a game in that or a thing. It was just that.
Or and definitely no Mexicans.
Yeah, and but you were Jewish. It was one of the two. So it was really hard. I remember when I was coming to faith, hearing very clearly Romans 2:28, what is a Jew? Not one outwardly to the praises of man, but inwardly to the praises of God. And that sustained me because she sent counter-missionaries after me. She really meant that I shouldn't do that because then, and I know this might be politically incorrect, but this is a very strong feeling in the Yiddish culture is that if you don't do that and pass that on, you are doing what Hitler didn't.
We heard that a lot. We were born really just after 14 years after the Holocaust. The community was still reeling. People were walking around, many, especially in grandma's neighborhood, with numbers on their arms.
And trauma stares. They had that, you know, stare of thousands.
We had lost almost our entire family.
So that plays certainly in coming to faith and when you minister to Jews, understanding that this is part of what, maybe if they're my age, then they heard the message for sure, that you are doing what Hitler didn't, which is a pretty powerful message to have to fight against.
Now, I have never seen Schlagen Kiporis, but I understand it involves a chicken and a lot of waving and maybe even some chicken poop. But then the chicken, it's supposed to absolve you of your sin right before Yom Kippur, and then said chicken is then given to the poor. They moved on to perhaps providing just tzedakah, but then the Hasidim decided it was a great idea. So we're back to swinging chickens.
Next slide.
This was just 13th Avenue.
We spent a lot of time there with our grandma. And looked kind of like that.
It was good times. Next slide. We talked about kosher foods, but the important thing, go ahead.
So the important thing, of course, not to mix meat or milk. I don't remember my grandmother having a kosher kitchen. She just didn't do that. Potato, of course, anything, because potatoes are cheap. Downstairs, I made potato knishes, which are very specific, delicious potato things. And we used up everything. So downstairs is fricassee. Be careful, there are bones. But that is basically what is made. You use chicken wings, you use chicken thighs, you use gizzards, use liver, but I forego the liver in that, and tomatoes. But again, you can hear it's, my daughter said that it sounds like a part stew, and that's kind of what it was. But if you don't have money, you make do with what you have. And of course, there was always the salami hanging on a hook.
Dried, it was delicious.
It was delicious. I'm not sure if, you know, it had bacteria in it, but if I could find a salami, I'd hang it on the wall. Mm-hmm. And sugar cookies. Again, you have to think about people who don't have a lot of money who are using what they have up.
The other thing is that you could make a latke. A latke is kind of like a pancake. Y'all have heard of potato latkes, I'm pretty sure, but I bet you haven't heard of green bean latkes, and I bet you haven't heard of salmon latkes. And again, it's not enough food. You use everything you've got. Next slide.
So we have a picture out there of our grandfather. He was a Broadway actor. He was a tailor. He was a beautician. He was many things. Sometimes I think I channel him in my own life. But there's a picture of him on Broadway. He played with such notables as the woman who was Yenta in Fiddler on the Roof. So
Molly Pickens.
Yes, Molly Dickens. So music, visual arts, literature, you had a little taste of klezmer. The first piece I had chosen for the klezmer, when I translated it, meant taking your in-laws home, so I decided to do a nagun instead. But often literature, it's a very rich culture.
Next slide.
These are just some images that I was able to find.
And Grandpa's up there in the far left in the middle. That's him, actually.
Is it?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
I remember watching on Broadway, they had something on PBS, and in the middle of it, my mom said, oh, there's Granny Pop-Pop. And he was in the show of the PBS thing. So, and that's not an uncommon thing in our family, because I saw my uncle on PBS talking about Russian Jewish culture. I had the flu, and I'm laying there. I'm going, that looks like Uncle Hank. It is Uncle Hank.
Yeah, I remember I saw one. I think I saw the same thing, but...
Next slide.
Somewhere else. Okay, this is where we're hoping it's going to work. Is it going to work, dear? This is Jimmy Cagney, and it's...
Island. Would you please tell me what you want? I'm a dentist.
What are you trying to do, kid me? All that I can understand is Ellis Island, Ellis Island, Ellis Island.
What about Ellis Island?
Reverse the game.
Ich will unterwohnen dann in Ellis Island, mein Freund. Kommt mit drei Kindern. Ein von Russland. Mein Name ist Alena Stagios-Levinovich. In diesem Bein gehen wir unter dem Ellis Island.
Right, I verstehe. Was geht in Ellis Island? The vibe is good.
What then? Du bist eigentlich ein Junge.
Nun, wo ist denn das Schäget? Hab's auch rein.
Nolan. What part of Ireland did your folks come from?
Delancey Street, thank you.
And that, my friends, is Yiddish. We have one more slide. We have one more. Here's the music.
That's not the side.
That's not it.
Although I'm sure he's a great dancer.
Technical difficulties, don't you love it?
Oh, here it is, yeah.
I hope.
Fingers crossed.
Mein Herz geht euch von dir. Mir euch war geht vor so. Die hast nicht kein Herz, du weißt, ich muss gar nicht mehr. Gott, was sie lieber.
So the subplot in this guy is Gentile, and she's a nice Jewish girl, and there's a lot of conflict because of that. So due to time constraints, we want to be respectful of your time. And there's one last slide that Ricky wanted to address, and it has very much to do with our experience.
I'm not on YouTube, at least not on that channel. So I'm going to start ahead. So what do you do in the diaspora when you live in Manassas, Virginia, or you live in Potomac, you're near Potomac Mills, or you live somewhere where there are no Jews? You start to make some rules of your own. And I think that my mother struggled with that because you couldn't walk to synagogue. There's no kosher grocery. Sometimes you're the only Jew around. And you're the minority. And from the Jewish culture, having been a minority was not always the best thing in the world. So my mom made the home the shul. And so I think that was her way of working around it. I think she would shop on Sabbath because she would say, well, I'm not working. That's not my regular job. So I'm not working on the Sabbath. And they're Gentiles. So they're supposed to work on the Sabbath.
And then there were the blue laws.
Yeah, so she was kind of free and loose so that but there were some very specific things. You don't marry outside the faith. We've kind of busted that one up. You don't believe in Jesus. We kind of goofed that one up. So for her to come to faith at some point, again, going back to what the scripture was about letting God be in charge, I think was a really important thing because there was a point where we had to allow God to take care of my mom and both of our position was, you know, Jesus has a Jewish mother too. He can help us out. And so he did, and she had a dream, and the rest is history. She came to faith, but she fought it like tooth and nail. But at the end of the day, she was sitting right there before her death. So I think there's a point where you just have to say that the Lord has decided to use us as stiff-necked, stubborn people. And because of that, he'll bring things to a proper conclusion. So
because he's in charge.
He's in charge. And we learned that with my mom.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But anyway, thanks.
Oh, glasses. Oh, wait, close. That was close.
Oh, those were Ricky.
I know it's a little late, but like I told you before, it could be worse. You could be working. Invite the elders to come up. We'll say the blessing. Last funny comment. You'll experience, if you ever go to a traditional Jewish synagogue, there'll be those who come to service and those who come to Oneg. Thankfully, we're the former. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace.